A pair of newlyweds had just settled into their first home in the weeks after the honeymoon, and in those early days, they were discovering one another's idiosyncrasies and the little peculiar habits that all of us have and that sometimes irritate one another. And she had a little habit that particularly began to get to him. Whenever he would ask her to do something, she would say, "Well, just a sec." And, you know, she'd eventually get around to doing it, but just a sec. Well, one particular beautiful Saturday afternoon, they were out in the backyard, as were all the rest of the neighbors playing or working in the yard, and her repeated, "Just a sec, just a sec," finally got to him. It was just too much, and in a very loud, irritated voice, booming out over the neighborhood so that all the neighbors could hear, he said, "No, no, no more sex. I'm sick and tired of sex." Well, after an embarrassing silence, the young man, realizing what the neighbors had heard, trying to make amends, in a rather sheepish but raised voice, he says, "Well, maybe just a little bit more." Oh, all right, you may sit down now. Oh, my. Isn't married life fun? That is our topic tonight. Just a sec. No, not really. The physical relationship in marriage. When God created man and woman, male and female, the Genesis record states, right at the end of Genesis chapter 1, the last verse, God is looking out over all that he has created, and he's just finished making man and woman, and he says, "Behold, it is very good." Now, I don't know whether you've ever stopped to think about that as how it impacts you personally. Six times prior to that statement, God has done a similar thing in the 6 days of creation. He has paused in his creative endeavors. He's looked out over what he has created, and he has said, "Behold, it is good. Behold, it is good. Behold, it is good." Six times he says that. But after he made man and woman, he looks out over that part of his creation and he says, "Behold, it is very good." Now that does something to me. I don't know whether it does to you or not, but it excites me to realize where I stand in God's economy. Where you stand as his created beings, right at the top of his priority list. Very good. I'm sure there are some of us here tonight who have a real problem with inner self-esteem. We have a hard time maybe liking ourselves or thinking that anybody else likes us. We're not really all we ought to be. We have problems with that. I would encourage you to read the first chapter of Genesis with the thought in mind that when you get down to that last verse, remember he's talking about you. You are very good in his sight. That's the wonderful creator that we serve. And according to God's own wisdom and design, sexuality was ordained by God for the propagation of the human race, for pleasure, and for an expression of the kind of love between a husband and a wife which nourishes true oneness. And neither the distorted image of negative puritanical attitudes which formulated the philosophy of sex for many years in our country and in other countries as well, nor the new morality or situation ethics which is so prominent today and throws off all restraints and argues for sexual freedom, neither of these two extremes is an accurate picture of what the Bible talks about in relation to sex. And we want to do that just a little bit tonight, by way of introduction. What does the Bible have to say? It talks about this subject quite a bit, far more than most of us probably realize. How many of you are familiar with the name Hugh Hefner? Okay. Almost everybody. The originator of Playboy and the magazine, the corporation, and also what is termed the Playboy philosophy, which is a hedonistic approach to life. I personally believe that Hugh Hefner has pawned off one of the greatest perpetrations against our country that anybody has ever pulled off. Because he has sold us down the river on a philosophy that is totally anti-biblical, against God, and yet has made it look so appetizing and so appealing. And many, many people in our country have fallen hook, line, and sinker for it. But listen, folks, when we take a beautiful thing like sex, which is God-originated, it is God's plan. He invented it. It was His idea. It's His gift to us. When we take anything, and there are a number of things that we could talk about that are in a similar vein, but when we take something like that and we begin to brutalize it and use it outside the boundaries which God has very specifically and clearly laid down for it in His Word, then it leads to heartache and broken lives and trouble and mixed up people. And that's what the Playboy philosophy eventually leads to, even though on the outside it's very glamorous and appealing. And that can be verified. Sex is a beautiful gift from God with a purpose. And I just briefly mentioned those three purposes, but let me repeat them for you. These are the purposes for which God has created sex. By the way, let me back up just a minute. If you have never read the book Christianity in the Wake of the Sexual Revolution, written by Randy Alcorn, put out by Multnomah Press, you should get a hold of a copy of it and read it. It is probably the most outstanding book on what has really happened within the church during the course of the sexual revolution that's taken place in our country. And it has taken place, whether you are aware of it or not. It has happened. But Randy does a beautiful job in explaining what has happened, what attitudes the church has taken, what it can do to correct those attitudes, which have been way out to lunch, almost a head in the sand type of thing, and what can be done about it. Christianity in the Wake of the Sexual Revolution. Multnomah Press, Randy Alcorn, Alcorn. Three purposes for which God has given us this beautiful thing we call sex. Number one, to provide for parenthood. He had to have a way to make sure that the earth was filled with people, to propagate the human race. When He told Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply, He had to have a way of doing that and making sure it would happen. If you want a couple of scriptures on that, Genesis 1, 27 and 28, Genesis 9, 1, and Psalm 127, 3. Secondly, to promote mutual love, the highest expression of the scriptural term, and the two shall become one flesh. That statement is repeated four different times in the scriptures. And then thirdly, the third purpose for which God has given us sex is to produce physical pleasure. Probably that has no equal. Now, I don't know whether you believe that God has a sense of humor or not. I happen to believe that God has a sense of humor. I mean, all you got to do is stand here and look out at an audience like this, and you realize that he has a sense of humor. And if I was in the audience, you know, it'd be the same way. But I see a little bit of God's humor, sort of a tongue-in-cheek kind of humor, in the relationship between a couple of these purposes for which he's given us sex, the first and the third. You see, God had to have a way of making sure that his command to Adam and Eve would be fulfilled and carried out. Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth with people. And what he did was invent a way of that happening. In fact, the only way for that to happen, that was so much fun and so enjoyable that a married couple couldn't stay away from it if they wanted to. Now, I don't know whether you see any humor in that or not, but I think God really sort of pulled a fast one on us. Especially, and I want to emphasize that I say this reverently, I mean this humorous thing, because when I stand back in awe, which I do, at the vastness of God's creative endeavors and power and ability, I mean, nothing is beyond the realm of possibility with God. You get out on a clear night and you look up at the sky, and especially here in Colorado, when we got a clear night and the stars are so bright, and you realize how vast that is out there, and it goes way beyond what we can see with our naked eye, and they've just sent this wonderful invention that they blew it on the mirrors, this Hubble telescope up into space, you know, and they're going to see 10 times further out, probably thought they could find God out there someplace, but now they blew it on the mirror, you know. Or you go down to the microscopic world, the other direction, and, you know, they're still finding how little things are. Well, God made all that. He did that. Well, he also invented sex, and you know, he could have had children reproduced as a result of any other way he wanted to. It just so happened that he picked sex, but he didn't have to do that. I mean, with all of the wisdom and knowledge and creative powers and genius that he had, he could have done it any old way. Right? Sure, I mean, he could have had children be reproduced as a result of a married couple exchanging earwax with a Q-tip. I mean, why not, huh? I'm glad he didn't, but he could have. God is a magnificent, almighty, powerful, wonderful person. We need to get to know him intimately. And as I said, he's got an awful lot to say about this subject in the Bible. Let me just call your attention to one that is kind of my favorite. There's a lot of passages that we could turn to, but turn to Genesis chapter 18, if you will, for just a minute. This is Abraham and Sarah, and they got a little problem. Years and years before this incident right here in chapter 18, God had come to Abraham. You got to go all the way back to chapter 12 in Genesis to find this, but years and years prior to this event that transpires in chapter 18, God had come to Abraham and he had promised him that he would have a son, that he and Sarah would have a son, and that as a result of that son, his children would reproduce themselves over and over again until it got so many that it would be like the stars in the heavens and the sand on the seashore. And God had come to Abraham on several occasions after that and repeated that promise. Well, but nothing had happened so far. And so here they are in chapter 18 of Genesis. There, Sarah is 90 and Abraham is 100. Now, you being in their shoes, you would have begun to wonder about this promise by now, huh? Well, that's what happens. And the Lord comes one more time. And we'll pick it up, let's say, in verse 9. The Lord is talking to Abraham, and he says, "Where's your wife, Sarah?" And Abraham says, "Well, she's in the tent." Then the Lord said, "Well, I'll surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son." Now God has put a date on it. Huh? Isn't that terrific? Now, Sarah was listening at the entrance to the tent which was behind him. Sarah was eavesdropping on Abraham's conversation with the Lord. No problem with that. I'm sure that God doesn't mind anybody eavesdropping on a conversation like that. Now notice verse 11. Abraham and Sarah were already old and well advanced in years. And Sarah was past the age of childbearing. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but 90 years old probably explains most of it, beyond the years of childbearing. Huh? Take a quick look. Keep your finger on that verse, but take a quick look back at chapter 17, verse 17. Well, you can back up really to 16. This is God speaking again. "I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her." God speaking to Abraham again about Sarah. Now down to 17. "Abraham fell face down. He laughed." Of course, you know, by this time, you'd begin to wonder, wouldn't you? He laughed. And he said to himself, "Will a son be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? I mean, he had a legitimate question, I think. So, you know, she was beyond the years of childbearing anyway. Verse 12 in chapter 18. Now, we're back to that. "So Sarah laughed to herself as she thought." Now, notice what she thought. "After I am worn out... and my master is old, will I now have this pleasure?" Now that word pleasure in the Hebrew language has the implied meaning of sexual pleasure. Isn't that fantastic? To think that the Spirit of God would move in such a way that he would just kind of stick in there that little word that has that meaning in this passage. I think it's beautiful. And so part of what Sarah was thinking about was, "Good night, Lord. Do you really mean that this old man and me are, you know?" Of course, she knew how children were born. There was no question about that in her mind. And of course, part of it was the pleasure that the son would be reproduced, and she would have a son. That was another part of the pleasure, is that you can pick that up from the next verse. "Then the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh and say, will I really have a child now that I'm old?" 14, and of course that's part of what she was thinking of the pleasure. And then God says, "Is anything too hard for the Lord?" And of course the answer to that is no, nothing is too hard for the Lord. Now I want to go one step further. Take your Bibles and keep your finger there in Genesis 18 and flip over to Hebrews chapter 11. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but this is so rich. Verse 11. Hebrews 11, verse 11. "By faith, Abraham, even though he was past age and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so," now notice verse 12, "and so from this one man," and he being as good as dead, "came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore." Listen, folks, we think we have problems. Huh? That God can't handle? No way. God is big enough to handle our littlest problems. In fact, as Carol and I were driving over yesterday afternoon in the car to come to the conference, she was saying to me, "Isn't it wonderful that God is interested in the little things in our lives and not just the big things?" And I said, well, what are you really saying, sweetheart? Because I knew there was really something significant behind that statement. And she says, well, we're just kind of two little people going over to speak to a conference of some other little people. But God is so interested in all of us. He loves every one of us. And He wants to pour out His blessing on us. Now, those are not her exact words, but something like that. But that's the way God is. He is able to meet all of our needs. Abraham and Sarah thought that there was just no way. And yet they kept trusting the Lord. Just one day at a time. And finally God comes along and then He puts a date on it. He says, next year at this time, it's going to happen. And it did. Don't ever give up on God. Huh? Don't ever give up on God. I think that's a beautiful passage of Scripture. But to think, will I now have this pleasure? Beautiful. Last night and this morning, we have been talking about the differences that exist between us as husbands and wives. And we have tried to emphasize on several occasions that we were not talking about man-woman differences. We were talking about people differences. Well, when it comes to sex, there are some significant differences between men and women, other than just the obvious outward physical form. And I'd like to mention about five of them to you, because they are vitally important for us to enjoy to the fullest and the maximum this wonderful thing that God has given to us. It's important that we understand these differences. For instance, to a man, sex is an act. It's an interlude in time. It happens and it's over and let's get on with the next thing. Now, I know you gals, when you hear me even say that, it kind of sends a chill up your spine. No, that's not the way it is. That's right. Not for you. But that's the way it is with a man. For a woman, sex is involved in all of life. It's part of the drama. It's a lot more than just turn it on, turn it off, and get on with the next thing. Now, men, we need to understand that, huh? I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Secondly, for a man, it's a strong physical drive accompanied with emotional needs. For a woman, it's strong emotional needs accompanied with physical needs. It's a matter of priority. Thirdly, for a man, sex is related to how often. That's more important, how often. For a woman, quality is the key factor, far more important. The how-to for a woman. Fourthly, for a man, he has a quick reaction to stimulation. For a woman, comparatively slow to react and needs to be stimulated. Now, you've got to realize that as I give you these five things, there are exceptions to every rule. But for the most part, this is the way people in authority tell us that it is. Fifthly, a man is stimulated primarily by sight, either through the physical eye or vicariously through his mind. A woman is stimulated by touch and tenderness. That's all, again, harkens back to the part of the drama of life. Now, those are five very significant differences between us as men and women when it comes to this matter of our attitudes and reactions to the physical relationship in marriage. I could kind of summarize those five things by this little illustration. A man is, when it comes to sex, is sort of like an electric light bulb. You flip the switch and on he goes. And then when it's over, you flip the switch and off he goes. A woman, when it comes to sex, is more like an electric iron. You flip the switch and it takes a little time for it to warm up. And then when it's over, you flip the switch and it takes a little time to cool down. Now, some of you guys are sitting there and you're saying, oh, yeah, okay, electric iron. you flip the switch and, two or three minutes and we're ready to go. No, not two or three minutes. Even though your iron, not your wife, but your iron, may warm up in two or three minutes. I'm not talking about two or three minutes here. I'm talking about 15, 20 minutes, a half hour. Let her call the shots on that. We'd spoken at a seminar one time and had stayed around town for several days after it was over, and Monday or Tuesday, we were down at a shopping center, and we ran into a couple who had been at the seminar. And they recognized us, and we recognized them, and we got chatting with them. And he said, hey, would you excuse me? I got to make a phone call. I looked at his watch, and so he ran off to find a payphone. And so we were left standing there talking with her. And she kind of got this, cute little look on her face that was kind of one of those looks, I really would like to tell you something, but I'm not sure I should. You know, one of those kind of looks. But finally she decided she would, and she said, you know, Monday afternoon from the office, Jim, her husband, called me at home from the office. He never calls me from the office unless it's a dire emergency, and there was nothing of an emergency on. But he called me, and he really didn't have anything to say. We just kind of chatted and talked a little while, and finally, you know, we kind of ran out of things to say, and it got quiet, and he said, sweetheart, turn on the iron, will you? And she kind of smiled, and we smiled, and I said, did you like that? And she said, oh, yeah, it was great. Now, gentlemen, I'm talking primarily to the men tonight. Carol is going to come up in a little while and talk to the women on the same subject. Gentlemen, it is absolutely atrocious how some men go about making love to their wives. No buildup, no drama, no soft lights, no clue as to what's coming that night, something that you have been thinking about on and off every time you get a chance all day long. Let me describe how it happens sometimes, huh? And you'll get my point. This couple, you know, supper is over. And up to that point, several times during the day, the thought has flitted through his mind, man, I really want to have some fun in bed tonight. But he hasn't said anything to his wife. No little, you know, pet statements that they have, no little catchphrases which so many of us have on this issue. Nothing had been said. She didn't have a clue. So supper was over. They go in the living room, watch TV a little bit, read the paper, and, you know, the hours slip by. Finally, it's bedtime. They yawn, go down to the bedroom. She goes in the bathroom, does her little chores, puts on her nightgown, climbs into her side of the bed, picks up the Reader's Digest, and starts to read. He goes in the bathroom, does his chores, gets his pajamas on, gets in his side of the bed, turns on the light, picks up Time magazine, and they lay there and for about 20 minutes and read. And finally, she kind of yawns, lays down the Reader's Digest, leans over, gives him a little pat, says, good night, sweetheart, turns out the light, rolls over. He reads Time magazine for another 5 minutes. Finally turns out the light, rolls over. And there they are, laying there in the dark. And 1 minute goes by. And 2 minutes go by. 2.5 minutes go by. And then out of the dark comes this hand. Come on, guys. We can do better than that. Don't misunderstand me. Now, I have nothing against spontaneity. It's probably better than nothing. One guy came up to me after I had told that story, and he said, Jack... He says, Jack, you will have to admit that a hand in the dark is better than a Q-tip in the ear. Couldn't believe it. I wish I could think of things like that, you know. Gentlemen, we have a responsibility to be a lover to our wives, to learn how to meet their needs in this area in a way that God intends us to. And sometimes one of our biggest problems is we don't know what's going on in each other's mind and heart. We don't know what pleasures each other because we've never talked about it. We've never talked about our sex life as a couple. There's some of you here who you've never gotten around to it. And you need to. In order to, the old song, coming, doing what comes naturally, that's for the birds. That isn't the way to really enjoy this to the maximum. We've got to know what's going on with each other. We've got to communicate on this subject. And some of you, I realize, you know, it may be more than you can do just to get the words out that need to be said in order to talk about the subject. Let me give you an idea on what can help you, or you could use it with other young couples or newly married couples to help them get over the hurdle of being able to talk about this. And it's a strange phenomenon to me. You would think that this would not be a problem in the free society that we now live in, with all that's on television and everything else you read. But it's not true. We can make jokes about it. We can watch TV. But for us to talk about our physical relationship together as a husband and a wife seems very difficult. But let me give you an idea on how to get started and how to approach this. Get a hold of one of two books, either The Act of Marriage by Tim LaHaye or Intended for Pleasure by Dr. Ed Wheat. If you want my choice on it, it would be the latter, Dr. Ed Wheat's book, Intended for Pleasure. They're both excellent. It's just that we know Ed and Gay Wheat very well, and they're terrific people, and it's a terrific book. Get the book and then begin to read it out loud together. The wife reads some and then talk about it if that's applicable to you. Then the husband reads some and then talk about it. Begin to communicate on this subject together as a husband and a wife. And that will help you because somebody else is saying the words, but you're saying them out loud yourself, but they're somebody else's words. That will get you started. See, we as husbands have a responsibility to be a real lover to our wives. You use your imagination in this. I mean, the sky's the limit. It's a phenomenal thing that God has given us. For instance, is it the same old bedroom every Thursday night? The same thing goes on. You know, you go in at the same time. It's the same old bedroom every Thursday night. Time and week in, week out. Or maybe it's Tuesday and Thursday or Wednesday and Friday, you know, whatever. Do you ever turn your bedroom into a Rocky Mountain High? It's late January. Now you're in your bedroom and it's Thursday night. But you're out in the Colorado Rockies. It's late January and you're skiing. And you're both swishing down the slopes and having a great time. And then, as can frequently happen in Colorado, a storm blows in very quickly. And you just got off the tow, you just started down, and man, this blizzard blows through and you can hardly see each other. You almost get lost from one another, but you manage to find each other. And then you very carefully are working your way down the slope. Don't know where you're going. You can't get back to the top. You can't get to the bottom. And you come across this little cabin out of nowhere. And there you are in the dead of winter, snow blowing around you. And the door's open. And you walk in and you take your skis off. And there in this cabin is a wonderful brick fireplace. And there's a fire all laid and a big bare rug in front of the fireplace. And there's some coffee and some other little goodies there. Now, what are you going to do? Well, brother, if you can't take it from there, you do have problems. But see, use your imagination that God has given you. Make this an exciting thing. Some of you guys have never gotten up the courage yet to walk into the lingerie department of a big department store and walk up to the counter, and there's a little 19-year-old chick standing behind the counter. And you walk up there, and without blushing, you say, I would like to have one of those in the light blue in a 34B. Oh, yeah, and that other little thing that goes with it that matches it, a medium, would you put that together and gift wrap it for me? Now, some of you guys don't have the courage yet to do that, but you ought to do it sometime. To buy your sweetheart a little love token, to take it home, something that you would like for her to wear just for the two of you to enjoy together. My wife refers to that as a little thingy. And I would challenge you guys, if you've never done that, to sometime during the next month, to get up your courage. You might even want to practice a little bit, but get up your courage and walk into the department store and do that. She may not even know, because you haven't talked about it, what degree of dress or undress really does turn you on. Maybe she just guesses at it, or, you know, have you really talked about that type of thing? Well, a little gift like that would certainly communicate something, wouldn't it, huh? You bet. Well, let me mention just a couple of other things, and then I'm going to quit and Carol's going to come up. One of the things that we are asked about, probably as frequently as anything else on this particular subject, is this the whole matter of having a climax together, right at the same time. And many books that you read on this subject, mostly secular, sometimes kind of hang this out as a carrot. That, boy, if you haven't achieved that, then you still got something really exciting to come. And personally, Carol and I feel that that's just a bunch of garbage. It's just a hook that really has no validity to it. God has given us this wonderful gift to enjoy together, to come to a love feast together and enjoy the feast. And whether we have the climax at the same time or one or both of us don't, that's not the point. It's to enjoy one another physically. That's the point. So don't let that be a hang-up to you. Another thing that we are asked about from time to time is, why is it on, I don't know why I'm particularly hung up on Thursday night tonight, but why is it on Thursday night we go into the bedroom and we go through this wonderful, exciting routine, and boy, when it happens, it's like skyrockets are going off, the fireworks are going, it's like we're bouncing off the ceiling, it's just a phenomenal experience. And next Thursday night, we go into the bedroom, and it's, you know, we go through the same thing. We do the same little routine. And there's no fireworks. There's no bouncing off the ceiling. It's just kind of a deep-seated sense of satisfaction. Why is that? I don't know. I know that's the way it is. I mean, but I don't know why. Maybe it's part of God's mystery that He's plugged into this thing and always wants to keep us guessing. Always wants to bring us back, huh? Yeah. Well, so don't let that. I kind of liken it to two different kinds of meals. You know, my favorite meal, if given my choice, it would be a nice, thick, probably inch and a quarter New York strip steak, medium rare, great big baked potato with globs of butter on top of it, some nice rolls, a nice salad, and then after that's all over, a big piece of apple pie with vanilla ice cream on it and a cup of black coffee. Now, you know, that really meets a need I have. But on the other hand, I like McDonald's hamburgers. A Big Mac is really tastes good once in a while. Now, obviously, there is a difference between a New York strip steak and the trimmings and a Big Mac and fries and a Diet Coke. But that's kind of the way sex is. Sometimes it's a New York strip steak, and other nights it's a McDonald's hamburger, you know? Now, both are satisfying, both are nourishing, both meet the need at the time. But there is a difference, huh? I know what you're going to think now the next time you pull in a McDonald's. I deserve a break today or something like that. Someone has said that the perfect mate for any man has been described as an angel in the home and a tiger in bed. And I really believe that most wives want to be that to their husbands. But husbands, we have a responsibility, an immense responsibility, to help them become that. And particularly in this area of lovemaking. To help them become the kind of spouse in bed, the tiger, if you will, that they want to be. And that we want them to be for us. Huh? Okay, let's take a little break.
We got another 30 minutes to go. King James Version uses for intercourse is, he knew her, and she conceived and had a son. I think that's a very beautiful expression that God has plugged in to the scriptures. He knew her. Because to me, sex is really total communication. Body, soul, and spirit. As we become one as a husband and wife. To most women, sex cannot be compartmentalized. To most women, sex and love are so intertwined in the very heart of our being that we simply can't separate them into categories. And I'm glad, because I think God has so much more for the sexual relationship than the world can even dream of. You know, the world tries to make sex just another body function. But God talks about sex, especially in Proverbs 5, as being a deep well. Ever drinking of this deep well, and it springs up and it refreshes you. The world would have us believe, as Proverbs 5 talks about too, that it's a very shallow thing. And it talks about sex there, a casual sex, as though it's just water on the streets of our life. Muddy puddles, really. But married love is to be that deep well. And it kind of sums it up in Proverbs 5, 15 to 19, where it says, drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well. Should your springs overflow in the streets, your streams of water in the public squares, let them be yours alone, never to be shared with strangers. May your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth, a loving doe, a graceful deer. May her breasts satisfy you always. May you be ever captivated by her love. That's God's view of sex in marriage. So I think that this too is one where we can say true love has no maximum. the kind of sex that God has for us, there's always new vistas ahead. There's always that deep, refreshing love that can spring up from being one together. One of the wonderful things about Scripture is that it is the best marriage manual that's ever been written. And as we follow God's principles, including the principles that He gives us for the physical relationship, we're going to grow to be more and more happy and fulfilled. Now, God doesn't give us all the techniques, although Songs of Solomon comes pretty close. As you study, really study that book in Songs of Solomon, gives you even positions and things like that, if you read it right. But God doesn't give you a sex manual as such, but He does give us principles to operate on in this whole area. And I'd like to share a few with you. One summer, a number of years ago, I had four different women come to me with four problems that they were having. At the time, I thought they were rather unusual, but I have discovered since that they really are not very uncommon. These were the four problems. And the wonderful thing as I share these with you is that God has the answers for all of them. One woman said that though she had been married for a number of years, she had never, to her knowledge, experienced a climax. Not unusual. The second one said one woman said that her husband so repulsed her that she couldn't stand to have him come near her sexually. He was quite obese, but this was not her problem. The third one said that she was so shy that she was afraid to undress in the room with her husband. And the fourth one said that her husband had not come near her in 4 years sexually. This was probably the most uncommon. And yet we are finding these days when there is so much drug abuse and alcoholism and a lot of other problems that it isn't as uncommon as we would like to believe. Now let me read you 1 Corinthians 7 in the Phillips translation. Get a hold of the Phillips translation because it is so clear when it comes to principles of operating our physical relationship. It says this: the husband should give his wife what is due to her as his wife. Now let me stop right there. The husband should give to his wife what is due to her physically as his wife. You see, that's the answer to that husband who has withheld himself for 4 years from his wife. He is not only sinning against her, he's sinning against God. Because this is a command from God. Now, granted that there are physical problems that can cause impotence and would be a reason that this man might not have come near his wife, but he can satisfy her even without intercourse. He can get help. There is help available. Dr. Ed Wheat, that Jack mentioned, is a sex therapist, and he claims that there are very, very few problems that he can't help someone with. And so, if we need help, we've got to go after it for God's sake, as well as for our loved one's sake. They used to tell us that 9 out of 10 cases of impotence were emotional. But anymore, they're finding that about half are actually physical problems. And just last year, I read an article from the Reader's Digest called Warning: Smoking Endangers Your Sex Life. And it says this: only a decade ago, doctors blamed 9 of 10 cases of impotence on emotional problems. Today, we know that at least half the time, the primary cause is physical. Researchers believe that by age 50, more than 25% of men rarely or never achieve a satisfactory erection. Because these men seldom talk about it, no one knows how many marriages are destroyed by this condition or how many desperate victims turn to alcohol or drugs. And then it lists 4 main risk factors for impotence, and they're these: caused by poor circulation, smoking, diabetes, elevated cholesterol, and high blood pressure. Now see, these are all treatable. So, this man needs to get help. And that's tough, because it's a tough subject. But God will help us and give us the strength. And then the scripture goes on to say, and the wife should be as fair to her husband. The wife has no longer full rights over her own person. And you see, that is the scriptural answer to that wife who was so shy. She needs to realize from God's standpoint that God created her for her husband, physically. And that she has no longer full rights over her own person, and that together they are one. Now, friends, a lot of women come to marriage with so many wrong tapes that play in their minds that it's very, very difficult for some women not to be shy. But there again, there's all kinds of hope in Christ, isn't there? Some of us need to ask God to renew our thinking, to give us the right thinking on this, and that's a process. To ask God to cleanse all that garbage that we've accumulated through the years, to give us a renewed mind, and to give us the way to look at sex the way God looks at it. That's beautiful. That's wonderful. And that we will really have the mind of Christ on this. Do you ever think about praying about your sex life? Do you ever think about praying about your sex life together? Or are some of you even now going, whoop, can I do that? Yes. You can pray about sex before you have sex, while you're having sex, after you have sex. You can pray. God wants to be involved in this. And so we take it to Him. He goes on to say, the wife has no longer full rights over her own person, but shares them with her husband. In the same way, the husband shares his personal rights with his wife. Do not cheat each other of normal sexual intercourse. Unless, of course, you both decide to abstain temporarily to make special opportunity for fasting and prayer. But afterward, you should resume relations as before, or you will expose yourself to the obvious temptation of the devil. Now, friends, if we take that and couple it with Matthew 18, verse 7, which says this, for it is necessary that temptations come, but woe to the man by whom the temptation comes. We have some wonderful applied principles for us wives. This is saying, wives, your husbands are going to be tempted. You better believe they're going to be tempted. They're out there with women who dress to the teeth, who can tempt them, who can try to seduce them. They're out there. They can't go buy a newsstand without seeing something that might tempt them. They can't watch television without seeing something that may stimulate them. But this is saying, woe be to you if you help that along by what you're doing, by how you're not really satisfying your husband, by how you're not giving yourself to your husband. Woe to you. Now, I'm not letting the husbands off the hook. You know, there are a lot of scriptures that say we're to look straight on, not to the right and the left. And when a husband falls into temptation and yields to it, that is his sin. But I am saying that if we're partly to blame, God's saying, woe to you, too. Now, where is that? What is that saying where we live? Well, it's saying we are wrong, wrong, wrong to punish our husbands by withholding ourselves from them. And wives are good at this. Someone has said to a man, sex is the most meaningful demonstration of love and self-worth. A husband's gift of sexual pleasure is full of meaning. It's a part of his own deepest person. How his wife receives him has a much more profound effect on him than most women realize. To receive him with joy and to share sexual pleasure builds into him a sense of being worthy, desirable, and acceptable. To reject him, to tolerate him, and to put him off as unimportant tears at the very center of his self-esteem. So wise, we need to examine ourselves carefully on this. Now, I do have to tell you men that because love and sex are all mixed up in the very center of our beings, it is very, very difficult for most wives to respond sexually when they haven't felt loved throughout the day. They want to get it settled before you want to have some fun. But wives, we can't let that be an excuse if it's not settled. Let me show you why. Often in our relationship, we have developed a little core of a good sexual relationship. And then our husband's boss gets on their back, or something happens and they're facing a distressing situation, and they come home and they take it out on us. You know, the dog gets out of the way, the kids are quiet, and you kind of don't do anything, and they really take it out on you. And things are rough around your house. And things are like this. And that night, your husband wants to have some fun in bed, and you say, oh, but I have this splitting headache. You probably really do have a splitting headache. But what does that say to him? It hits at the very heart of his manliness, of his worthiness, of his self-esteem. And so it gets worse. And out here, life becomes more and more difficult. And so that night he may want to have sex, and you just don't even make an excuse. You just say, thanks, but no thanks, buddy. And it gets worse. Until sometimes this kind of situation ends up in the divorce court. And you blame your sex life. And it hasn't been your sex life at all. It's been your attitude toward your sex life. But if a wife can before God say, when this situation happens, Lord, you know how hard it is for me to respond physically when I don't feel loved. But I love this man, and I'm committed to this marriage. And so, Lord, you help me respond. Well, what's going to happen? Developed a little area here called sex. And then things get all stirred up here. But that night your husband says, honey, let's make love. And you say, you bet. And things start to smooth out. And all of these things become better out there in life because of this wonderful thing that God has given you. You see, interesting little phenomenon here. I call sex the oil in the machinery. Jack calls it the frosting on the cake. Now think about that, and you'll see how it fits into what he just told you. The interlude, and yet all of life. Sex to a man makes everything okay. Sex to a woman means everything is okay. And there's real significance in that. But let's get back to the scripture. It says, do not cheat each other of normal sexual intercourse. Well, your next question is, what's normal? Well, you can read all the books and you can get 100 different answers. Average, they tell you, is 2.5 times a week. I don't know how one does a half a time, but that's what they tell you. But the fact is, friends, forget the statistics. Forget average. You are having that love feast together Whatever pleasures both of you is what is beautiful in God's eyes. Now, when Jack was talking about using your sanctified imagination just to make this fun, he was not talking about fantasizing. There's a big difference about changing your bedroom into something that's really more fun than fantasizing. Fantasizing generally means that you are thinking of having sex in wrong ways or with other people. That is sin. Our desire is to be toward our husband. Our desire is to be toward our wife. But let your imaginations reign otherwise. You see, what pleasures a woman? Well, intimacy, closeness, being held, the love feast is more important to a woman than most men have any idea of. In fact, many times a woman will want sex not for the climax or orgasm. They will want sex for the intimacy and the closeness and being held. And the woman who said, I've never experienced a climax, believe it or not, some women never have experienced a climax and have a wonderful sex life. They've told me this. Now, how is that possible? Well, it's possible because of this fact that a woman values the closeness, the love, the intimacy. And that, to many women, is much more important than the explosive feeling of the orgasm. So, men, if I can give you a little hint, don't put your wife under the pressure of saying, how was it? Did you come? Don't do it. Why? Sometimes she doesn't care. Now, of course, there are things that you want to begin working on. In these books, we don't go into all the technical details. We don't feel we're qualified. And you can read those in a book. And we trust you will. But, oh, friends, we're trying to go into some of the problems that we hear about time and time again. And this is one of them. But you see, you will want to be working at experiencing a climax, sure. But that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is coming together in this beautiful thing and loving each other deeply, wonderfully, and experiencing that. Now, one other thing here. Well, a couple of other things. The Charlie Shedd has a wonderful little book called Letters to Karen, and just written to wives and how to treat a man. And he has another wonderful book called Letters to Philip, and that's how to treat a woman, and you really need to get a hold of those and read them once a year. But Charlie says that most of the time a man has other things in his mind than women do. And he says this on sex. But from the marriages I have seen in consultation, it is apparent that how often usually matters most to the man, and the how to is most important to the woman. Yet no matter the frequency, the main thing is to come to it joyfully. There will be no exception to this rule. You are a prudent wife when you look on sex in part as your opportunity to be a blessing to your husband. The tender woman trains herself to receive a great measure of contentment just from contenting her man. That's the unselfish part of sex. And then he says in an article called The Saint and the Sweet Little Sinner, he said, the perfect mate for any man has been described as an angel in the home. And he says a devil in bed. Jack doesn't like that, so he says tiger. But please understand what Charlie means here. But the wives I have known who could qualify for such an accolade are in the minority. I see their opposite often in consultation. Some of them proudly announce, I never refuse him. They remind me of hopeful heroes waiting in line for the Purple Heart. Actually, that might be the worst thing you can say about your marriage. Now get this. Any man gets weary if he must always make the first move. So let's start with this, Charlie says, and I'll give you a few pointers on becoming the saintly little demon who can keep her man the kind of man she wants him to be. And his first point is, be sexually aggressive some of the time. Never forget that a husband wants to be wanted. Your husband longs to believe that he's wonderful enough for you to yearn sometimes for his sexual companionship. It matters everything to a man if he has a home where he knows he is of inestimable value as a man. Your husband can stand much more in the rough and tumble of a cutthroat world if you have convinced him that there is a waiting emotional center where he is vitally important. Now, of course, you need to talk about this, too. Jack has met a few men who are intimidated if their wives make the first move. And if you are, you need to let your wife know that. If you're not, you need to let her know that, too. But most men want their wives to be sexually aggressive some of the time. His second point is, don't be afraid of experiment and variety. Sex ought to be fun. And his third point is, keep your body alluring. Now, this is goes both ways. Remember what Jack said, that men are stimulated primarily through their eye gate? Well, women are stimulated by all of their senses, what they hear, the soft music or the romantic things that you're saying or whatever, their ears, their eyes, yes, their touch. But you know what else they're stimulated by? Their smell. There's nothing sexy about body odor. There is nothing sexy about bad breath. Gentlemen, there is plenty of soap in this world today to go around. I have had wives tell me this, that they simply cannot respond because their husbands smell so bad. Well, so it goes both ways. We need to talk about these things. Years ago, one woman made this statement to me. She said, I'm convinced that almost 100% of problems in the sexual area are due to selfishness. And I looked at her and I thought, oh, friend, you've got to be kidding. But the more I hear, the more I realize that maybe not 100%, but a great many of the problems that we face are due to the fact that we are selfish. What do I mean? Let me give you a couple of examples. I remember talking to one wife, and she said, you know, Carol, I realize that God made my body for my husband to enjoy. But she says, I know that I've really got to get God's perspective on how he created me. But she said, the truth is, I just don't like my body. I don't feel good about how I look. And yet, she said, my husband insists on making love in broad daylight. She says, I simply cannot get turned on. Now, friends, what is that? That is selfishness. Now, yes, she needs to renew her mind. Yes, she needs to give to her husband, even though she doesn't feel like having sex in the daytime. But her husband needs to woo her, too, and be unselfish enough to let her have those soft lights and all of those things that she requires to be able to respond. Another wife told me, she said, you know, when we make love, my husband is so verbal. He just talks all the time. And she says, I can't concentrate on how I'm feeling. Well, it is funny. And yet it wasn't funny to her. And I said, well, have you ever thought about asking him to just be quiet and let you feel one time and then let him be verbal the next time? It's a give and take, isn't it? It's giving. It's being unselfish. Some women hate to make love during their menstrual period, and their husbands don't understand that. Have you talked about these things? Some wives need much more time to respond, and husbands are very quick. And so they rush things, and wives get so they pretend. What about the wives who have never enjoyed sex, or who have never experienced a climax, or who rarely do? This is probably one of the most difficult problems that we hear about. As Jack has said, sex to a woman, you do not do what comes naturally necessarily. Sex to a woman is a learned response. You'll never read this in a book. At least I've never read it in a book. They wouldn't let me put it in ours, so you won't read it. But this is true. I've checked it out with doctors. Most women, well, all women, their sexual response, when they're born until they are going to puberty, have simply no sexual response at all. Then they reach puberty, begin to menstruate, and they begin just a tiny bit to develop some little bits of feelings on that. However, in the best of times, sex, when they hear about it, is usually repulsive. In fact, my sister and my mother presented sex in the very best way that could possibly be presented. But my sister, when she found out that women and men have, I mean, husbands and wives have sex more than just to have children, her eyes got this big and she says, "Even Christians." So, this is generally how we respond. Then you fall in love. And because love and sex are so intertwined, as I've said, then is when the sexual feelings begin to grow rapidly. And so they grow up, and hopefully right there you'll get married before you have intercourse. But as you know, this little drawing is rarely what happens. This is the idea. But what really does happen? Well, even from birth to when we begin to develop in puberty, often we have a mother who says, "Oh, I only do it because he makes me." Or we have negative tapes playing in here, and this line is just broken. We are hearing terrible statistics these days of 25%, they say, of all women before they get through their teenage years have been violated. And 25% of that 25% has been by a member of their own family. Well, what does that do to women? It breaks this. Or we may get through this period just fine, but we reach puberty and we start into our teenage years, and of course everything we see on television, there's one kiss and then the next scene you see and they're in bed. And so you think, to be popular or whatever, you'll make love in the back seat, you'll have sex on the back seat, you won't make love. And so you don't really enjoy it. Most women wouldn't really enjoy it. They just do it. They feel guilty about it, whether they've ever been raised that way or not. And this is broken. Or they develop and they fall in love. And then the sexual feelings are really beginning to grow fast. But of course we know so many, and I know there, I'm talking to them, have sex before you're married. Way down deep, there's guilt. You know, and then when you become a Christian, you know you've sinned before God, but you haven't put that, you haven't really confessed. You haven't come together on that. And it's broken. I have women tell me that sex, why was sex fun here? And then they got married, and now they can't respond. I have a number of women that tell me that. Well, why is it? They've never dealt with the guilt back here. This would be a terribly hopeless picture for probably 80% of us if it wasn't for God. But friends, we have a wonderful God. A God who can forgive. A God who can renew. But if you are in this boat, and as a result, you are not experiencing sex in a way that you know God wants you to have sex. The depth, the joy, the delight. Let me give you a couple of suggestions. Husband, you're going to have to be very patient if your wife is this way. And please, wife, if you've never experienced a climax or anything and your husband doesn't know it, just don't go to him and say, you know, I never have enjoyed this at all. Don't, please don't do that, okay? But you may want to go to him and say, you know, honey, I know that there's a whole lot more to this than I've been able to give you. And I need your help. Can we try some things? If you were to go to a sex clinic with this kind of dysfunctional problem, what they would tell you would be to take a couple of weeks away from everything. I know, you can't do that. But that's what they would tell you. Just take, go away. And spend the first few days just with a lot of affection. Just a lot of hugging and kissing. Why? Well, you're beginning to develop responses that have no pressure with them yet. And then they would say, after a few days of just hugging and kissing and a lot of affection, start touching sexually, but don't have intercourse. Well, what are you doing? Well, you're finding out where to touch, how to touch, what feels good, what you respond, what your response is, and once again, you're beginning to develop responses that one thing will trigger another thing that will trigger another thing, and you build up those feelings. Then they'll say, and then go ahead and have intercourse. You are beginning to learn the right responses. Now, if you should be in this boat, husbands, let me say this one thing to you. Let your wife call the timing. A wife cannot really have a climax unless her clitoris is stimulated. She may have to tell you how to do that, how long to do that, and when to stop. May take lots of time, but God can give you the wisdom to do that and give you all that He wants you to have, no matter what your line looks like in your background. As we close, I'd just like you couples to hold hands and bow your heads. And I'm going to read a paraphrase from 1 Corinthians 13. And my prayer is that as I read this, it will be your pledge to each other in all areas, but especially in this area of the physical relationship. I will give to you a love that is patient, a love that is kind, a love that endures. I will pledge to you a love that is not jealous or possessive, a love that is not proud or selfish, a love that is not rude or inconsiderate. My love for you will not insist on its own way, will not be irritable or resentful, will not keep account of wrongs or failures. It will rejoice when good prevails. Our love will know no limit to its endurance, no end to its trust, no fading of its hope. It will outlast everything. Our love will stand when all else has fallen. Our life together will have three great qualities: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest is love.